From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Look, the writer Joshua Wolf Schenck gets it. Creativity is hard to explain. When something amazing happens, like a painting or a song or a discovery, it seems impossible to account for it. So what we usually do is attribute it to the work of the lone genius. Creativity, we say, is some mystery buried inside the individual, which makes for a good story, but Schenck says it's a fantasy. It doesn't work that way because it doesn't take into account all kinds of things, among them the social qualities of creativity and innovation. It's a social thing, and it turns out it happens in pairs. That's the ideal unit. Today in the program, Schenck is joining us to make his case. He has plenty of examples: Watson and Crick, Wozniak and Jobs, Lennon and McCartney. The powers of two. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book about how creativity and innovation works in pairs, the writer Joshua Wolf Schenck tells a story from the fall of 1966. John Lennon had been away from the Beatles for several weeks, and when he returned, he had a rough demo of a song that he had recorded at home. And so he played it for the band. About a month later, that rough song became Strawberry Fields Forever, and Schenck says it was the practice of Lennon and Paul McCartney to answer each other's songs. So shortly thereafter, McCartney brought in his answer, his response, which was the song Penny Lane. That's how it worked, he said. John and Paul worked together and opposed each other. Their competition was an animating force in their relationship. There was give and take and rank and link and compare and cohere. Schenck has written a book that says the ideal unit for creativity and innovation is the couple, the pair, and he's joining us today to talk about it. The book is called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Joshua Wolf Schenck is the curator of Arts in Mind. It's a series of conversations in New York City about the creative arts and psychology. He's also a member of the Moth Radio Hour's General Council and the author of the book Lincoln's Melancholy. He's joining us today from the studios of member station KUOW. That's in Seattle. He's on book tour there. And Joshua Wolf Schenck, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you can tell you're a Beatles fan by
yes.
The book. And I think if anyone really is, the prologue of the book, which I want you to start with, is going to fascinate you. It's this story told by this British journalist, Hunter Davies. This is March of 1967, and John and Paul are in Paul's house, as you tell it, and they're working out this song for Ringo, which is going to be a little help from my friends. But would you take us through that? Because I think, and we'll sort of break this down as we go, but that's such a good indication of what you're seeing in those few hours that give you a sense of how a creative partnership works.
Yeah. John and Paul often got together in the afternoon and would, you know, spend the whole afternoon and early evening together before going to the studio. In this case, they were at Paul's house, which is right around the corner from Abbey Road in central London. And they had worked out the music for this song that they meant to be the song on the album for Ringo to sing, but they were still trying to get the lyrics. And Hunter Davies, who was writing a book about them, sat in the afternoon. It's one of the very few intimate glimpses we have of these sessions, which were constant. They got together whenever they, you know, needed new material and spent such a long amount of time together. And one of the most beautiful things in the Davies account, as you see how much time they are alone together, banging away at the piano, whiling away at the guitar. He says that one of them would come up with something beautiful out of this mass of noises, and the other would pluck it out of the air and try it himself. Mm-hmm. And you have a sense of two people who are really fluidly playing with one another and sort of moving towards something, but very slowly and with a lot of time on their hands. It ended up being about a 5-hour session, and they really only wrote a handful of lines, the iconic lines of the song that we all know so well. And it was a very gentle back and forth and give and take. And, you know, one person suggested something and the other came back at him. And, you know, from it, the song emerged.
Yeah. It's funny. I have to say, I just love the moment where this is the first time at this session Paul plays Fool on a Hill for John. And you talk about how Davies describes it as John just sort of staring off into the distance, listening to it. And he says there was really no discussion about it.
Yeah.
I'd say as a Beatles fan, that's kind of really cool and really amazing.
Yeah, I'm so moved that you pick up on it, because it's such a small moment in the Davies account, but I think enormously meaningful, because, you know, we don't think about collaboration nearly enough. We think about the lone genius and believe that, you know, creative fires are, you know, breathed from the mouths of these titans, Einstein and Gandhi and Hitchcock, when in fact critical relationships are always operating, and that's what I found in many years of research. But when we do look at two people together, we tend to think only about the physical, only about the concrete exchanges, what one person said, the marks that he made on a paper, or the specific suggestion that he voiced out loud, when so much of what happens between people is how they come to get in each other's head in a psychological relationship. And if you imagine what it feels like for Paul McCartney to play Fool on the Hill for his partner for the first time, and you know that Lennon's approval, approbation, excitement is the platinum standard for McCartney. It's what he's always going for, always gunning for. You have a sense of him being stirred and moved by the presence of his partner. And also, he was stirred and moved by the presence of his partner when they were not physically together.
Yeah.
And a kind of entwinement that happened between them that was, of course, nurtured through many, many hours, you know, hundreds, thousands of hours in each other's presence in performance spaces, in the studio, you know, at each other's houses, on the road. But it also existed when they went off, you know, into their own sphere. And that's one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why the pair is such an unusual unit for creativity, is because it allows people to move very fluidly between creative solitude and creative connection. And one of the things we need to get over is this idea that solitude and connection are at odds with one another, when in fact they really do work beautifully together. And one of the places that you see that happening is in high-functioning pairs.
It seems like the takeaway is that it's about that social connection. Because there are, it's interesting though that you write about, there are two myths here. One of them, of course, is that it's all about the lone genius. And you break that down, how the myth of the lone genius sort of came to us from the Enlightenment. And then there's another myth that sort of is getting currency now, that creativity is the result of a big social network, the network theory,
right,
of human achievement. But that doesn't really work either. Because it's hard to apply day to day. And it also, you say this, it doesn't take into account intimate relationships. So what you come up with, I guess, is the number two, the pair. That's the creative unit. That's sort of the principal thing here. That's the thing that you came to, I guess.
Yes. And it makes sense if you think about, where do we begin? We begin, you know, our lives by locking eyes with one other person. And the dyad is the root of our experience. It's actually the root of our thinking. When we're in conversation as small children with caregivers, there's something external happening, and eventually this is a simplistic metaphor, but an illustrative one, that external exchange becomes downloaded and gets into our mind. And that's what thinking is an external conversation that's brought into the mind. And the dyad is a very special unit, because it can be your whole world. We're social creatures, and so we need another person to make reality with. Mm. And yet it's immensely fluid and flexible. It's so small that people can move around. You can take positions and then you can switch positions. One person can generate ideas while the other responds and critiques them, and then you can reverse course. And if you even add a third person, you're going to have more structure and more stability, which can be very useful. And there are reasons why you have trios and quartets and so forth. But even within those trios and quartets and larger groups, if you look for where the major advances are happening, it's often happening in dyads who've broken off from that larger group. So with Monty Python, there were six guys, but they would break into pairs to do the critical work. And the same with movements like the Impressionists or the creators of psychoanalysis or the suffragists in the 19th century, the critical work very often happened in pairs. And so it's worth us paying attention to this model. And it does allow us to grapple with the fundamental quality of creative intimacy in the sense of being vulnerable and open and excited and elevated by another person. And really becoming more ourselves in relation to another person, which sounds like a paradox, but we all know intuitively how that can be through friendships and romantic relationships. It's just, it's not been brought into the field of creativity before because we have been so fixated on these two myths, as you described so nicely a moment ago, the myth of the network in which human, any individual human, you know, idiosyncrasy is totally effaced. And then the opposite extreme, where you it seems as though one person in the spotlight is, you know, somehow magically breathing this from his mind.
Yeah. The most basic element here, and there are a lot of elements at play, so I want to sort of go through some of them. The most basic, of course, is similarity, and this makes sense. People who have common interests and sensibilities come together in the first place. And there's a great story you tell. A 27-year-old investor in Omaha pitching an investment fund to some family friends. You want to take it from there?
Yeah, it's nice not to name him because at the start, you know, who is this kid? And he didn't have that much money. He pitched these family friends. One the man was a doctor, and his wife was there too. And I think he had $300,000 in total assets that he was investing at the time, and he. The at the end, that they really didn't seem to be listening or paying attention to him. They seemed distracted, and he finished his pitch and they said, okay, we're going to give you $100,000, which is basically all we have. We're going to hand that over to you to invest. And this young man said, well, why would you do that? You know, why you hardly seem to be listening to me. And they said, well, you remind me of Charlie Munger. And that's the first that this young investor, whose name was Warren Buffett, heard the name of the man who he would soon be introduced to and begin to learn from and then make deals with and eventually form a totally entwined partnership that is so interconnected that Warren Buffett has said, Charlie does the talking, I just move my lips.
Right.
Of course, we don't know Charlie Munger, most of us. I mean, if you are a student of finance, his existence is not a secret. But he's hardly well known on the scale of the Oracle of Omaha,
yeah.
And yet they are totally entwined. And this is something that shows up over and over again, that we only know one member of a partnership. We know George Lucas, but we don't know the contribution of his wife, Marcia Lucas, who was an enormous influence, beyond influence. You could say really on some level a co-creator of those early Star Wars movies. We know Vincent van Gogh, but we don't know about his brother Theo. And both Vincent and Theo agreed that they had co-created the work that we attribute to Vincent van Gogh. And it's not necessarily a problem that these offstage partners are given a different kind of credit, but it becomes a problem when we lose sight of them.
Right.
And when we want to understand the work and we don't have them as part of the story, and it becomes a problem when we then go to make creative work ourselves and we don't understand that all great things have arisen out of relationships and that we need to be thinking about that in a primary way.
Well, and there's a crucial lesson here too. Another way of kind of busting that lone genius myth is that it's about connection. It's important for people who are isolated, you say, to reach out, to make some kind of contact and make that first step, because this seems like this is a really crucial part about these creative partnerships. There's that first step which then really builds kind of exponentially.
That's right. And it is, you know, that is the impulse that this material leaves me with, which is, you know, where can my capacities and my imagination be activated, be extended, be supported, or where might it support some other person's vision so that I can do something really meaningful? And, you know, following the lessons of these great artists and great activists, all of these great creators, it really is about animating that impulse, which is simultaneously exciting and also, you know, carries with it some vulnerability, because there's a sense of not being in total control. And, you know, we naturally get involved with our egos in our work and want to feel that it's, you know, that it's ours and not someone else's. And there is some necessity of yielding that to a sense of the collective, although not entirely.
No, right. Well, but also I think it's also the difficulty seems to be just getting out there, because one of the things you write about are these magnet places, you know, putting yourself in a place where you're going to find, you know, kindred spirits. Matt Stone and Trey Parker, that's a remarkable creative partnership. They met in a film class at the University of Colorado. You mentioned how cafes, good magnet places, cities in many ways are magnet places writ large.
Yes.
And the idea is to, you know, go someplace where you might meet someone who agrees with you.
Yes. And just speak about your interests, you know. What are you into? What do you want to do? When people around you know about what you care about, what you're excited about, they will naturally make connections. Many partners do meet at magnet places, as you say, and many are introduced. You know, hey, Steve Jobs, I know that you're into, you know, pranks and electronics and you know, here's this other guy named Steve Wozniak. He's into the same stuff. That's how they met. Hey, Paul McCartney, there's a band that's playing, you know, at this church fete, and they're pretty cool. Right. My friend John Lennon's in it. Why don't you come check it out? And that's how Lennon and McCartney first encountered one another. And, you know, so, and the bigger picture here is that there is this constant interplay between who we are as individuals and what we most want to do, and connection. And you see this, that it's a dance back and forth. And it does often begin with, well, who am I and what am I about and what do I most love? And both those instances, people had really declared it. There also are times when you meet someone and are just carried away by his vision. So when this young man named Giancarlo Giametti was an architecture student in Rome, he met a designer named Valentino Garavani, and Valentino was already, magnificently accomplished and really showing great promise as a designer, but he also was going bankrupt. And Giancarlo said, "Well, I like you. I am excited by your art, and I think I could contribute something. I think I'm not a business genius, but I think I can add two and two and know that they make four. And that's apparently something that you're not able to do on your own." And from those very humble beginnings, these two men embarked on a journey that led to the most successful and influential, you know, fashion operation in the 20th century. And it's entirely clear that neither could have done anything like it on his own. Valentino had shown that he was entirely impractical. And he said, "The only two things I know how to do are to throw a party and sketch a dress." And Giancarlo, you know, built the logistical infrastructure, which is itself an enormously creative act, to prop up these dreams. And it's really the two of them together, although we've hardly known anything about Giancarlo, and we know very little about many people who are in that position, the kind of hidden position, the offstage position.
It's interesting that these partnerships, the next layer in these meeting stories is that it's not just the similarities that draws them together, but also there are those profound differences. Jobs and Wozniak, you mentioned, they're good examples. You write about Wozniak is pretty shy, pretty retiring, and we all know Jobs wasn't mercurial and charming. This is how you put it in the book. You say we need similarities to give us ballast and differences to make us move. So you've got to have the combination of those. They've got to somehow be in the right kind of balance to get it right, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, we need rapport. We need an alignment of values and vision. We need, on a very basic level, just to feel comfortable enough with somebody to feel understood and accepted. But we also need to be challenged. We need to be pushed. And what I found with these epic pairs is that both those conditions came together in extremes. So if you look at Lennon and McCartney again, their similarities are just extraordinary and incredibly unusual. The degree of their passion for this work, their sense of humor, their drive, how precocious they were. And yet they also were entirely different. Paul was meticulous, and even at 15 years old, a great mime. He could kind of ingest the style of Buddy Holly or Little Richard or Carl Perkins and kind of do these perfect imitations and memorize lyrics and get the chord changes exactly right. Whereas John Lennon was much more swaggering and full of bravado and wanted to play with lyrics and break them and vamp, in the middle of a tune that maybe he hadn't learned the lyrics to, or maybe he'd learned them and was deliberately setting them aside. So out of that connection around the music that they both loved and their shared desire to perform and to perform at a really high level, and these profound differences that were so animating and exciting to both of them and challenging, that was the nucleus, and they immediately spotted each other and the potential they had together. A young man who was a member of Lennon's band said that they were circling each other like cats.
Right.
And I love that image because it gives you a sense of how this is an animal quality, this arousal. We use these metaphors, chemistry or electricity, for a reason. It's a physical thing, and on some level it is something you just have to feel to know, but describing it and creating a language around it and looking at its basic criteria, I think, are helpful too, so that we can pay attention to these two things that we need. We need both the similarity and the opposition.
And the book gets at the nature of creativity in this way, and in a number of ways, but a lot of the time you'd say this idea of creativity, the nature of it, is kind of a vague term, a vague idea. But you say it's a stand-in for universal good, that we think of creativity, that's good, like it means happiness. But you make it clear in the book, creating new useful things or cool music or great pieces of art is as much, you say, about discord as it is about union. I think that's almost as important, it seems, that yin and yang, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, it's taking apart the expected and the comfortable, and often, going into the unknown and drawing out of it something new. And we love the work of Vincent van Gogh now because it's become so familiar to us, and it's been, we've been educated around art with that, those works at the Pantheon. But at the time, breaking from tradition, breaking from the expected styles of the Salon, he was, hardly accepted. And there's an enormous amount of courage. And often what pairs do for each other is that they create their own reality where this new work is accepted and valued. And they give each other space to push it along in the time when it's not so good. They listen to each other's early drafts and they see the promise and potential in it and allow each other to get better until, it is a fully formed piece of work. A lot of what John and Paul did for each other was have the patience to be with each other over long periods of time. Mm. And, the work ethic is one thing, but it's also the joy and the excitement and the sense of alignment with each other that, we're in this together for as many weeks or months as it takes to produce a single song sometimes, which is the way that little squib from Strawberry Fields Forever became the finished song. I think it was about 5 weeks.
Wow.
And that's not, dipping into the studio here or there. That's spending whole nights in the studio. Multiple takes, multiple tries, multiple sessions.
Well, we need to take a break. I wanted to move on with more Beatles. We could talk about the Beatles for the whole time, and I guess we should say this, Joshua Wolfshank. If you love the Beatles, you're gonna love this book. And I guess in some ways that's part of what really animated this story for you, is just your basic affection for the Beatles.
I love them, and it's a great story, and they light up all the themes, and I wanted people to experience this story as a story, and that's why I entwine a number of stories, but try to return to some familiar characters, yeah, so that you can see that this begins somewhere and it moves somewhere and it grows over a life, and that's how we can really access this.
Joshua Wolfshank, curator, essayist, author of the new book, Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West and KUER. This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the chemistry between great partners / rivals. Think Lennon and McCartney, Wozniak and Jobs, Watson and Crick, Larry Bird and Magic Johnson. Joshua Wolfshank says this idea of the solitary genius is a myth. Where there's an amazing invention or piece of art, there's usually two people involved. He's breaking down what he's learned about how it works and what it takes to create something great with someone else. This book is called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. So I wanted to ask you about, there's this moment you say, this moment in the book of confluence. At some point, two people in a pair come together and they kind of share this identity. I mean, it's almost like you often hear identical twins. You know, they have their own kind of language. They don't really need to verbally say anything. They just need to look at each other. And I guess this is what happens in these pairs.
Yeah, the identical twins are almost, they talk about ESP in the sense that, you know, the physical laws of the universe are somehow bending, you know, around the connection of their two minds, and that does happen with pairs too over the course of time, and it's in a way, you know, magical and mysterious, but you could also look at it in terms of basic psychology, that with repeated experience with what we call tacit experience, two people can grow so familiar with one another that their language becomes entwined. Sometimes their facial features are so often mimicking each other that they actually begin to look alike. Mm-hmm. And on some level, they are actually coming to a shared mind. So that, to give an example, you may encode the world around you in terms of the things that you know and the things that your partner knows. And a whole body of knowledge or possibility is sort of, it's as though there's a file cabinet in your mind marked with the name of your partner. And that's what you think of when you turn to that material.
You say creating something original is really remarkable if you think about how conformity is itself a biological imperative. You know how, you know, tens of thousands of years ago or whatever, if you got thrown out of the pack, you could die. So this impulse to want to do something original sort of goes against our biological imperatives, and it's pretty, I don't know if courageous is the right word, but it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so glad you bring that up. I mean, it because we take for granted when something you know, stunningly beautiful is before us, that it seems so natural. And yet we're also very familiar with the stories of how great things are made and how they have to pass through so much difficulty. I mean, the story of Seinfeld, the sitcom,
right,
which now is just, you know, it's part of the DNA of our culture. But at the time, you know, it was just bizarre. These two neurotic writers, Jerry Seinfeld and Larry David, who didn't really have a story, and it was just kind of two guys chewing over their experience and making fun of things and kind of puzzling over the enigmas of everyday life, and no one really knew what to do with it. And it was this very slow, halting start. They, you know, gave them the green light, green light to do a pilot and then a few episodes and a few episodes more. And the first season was very marginal. It was, you know, should we continue with this? I mean, it was like, it was hardly a rousing success. And right. It was the commitment that these two guys had to their shared vision, that they believed in it. And that's what mattered most of all to them. And so there was this nucleus of energy that carried them through. And they grew better and better and funnier and sharper until it became what we know it to be. And it is enormously courageous. And we do need the kind of support and affection and faith of at least one other person in order to push through that barrier, which is so tremendous. You know, one of the things that happens in creative pairs is that one guy says to the other, "Is this crazy?" And the other guy says, "Yeah, this is crazy. Let's do it."
Right.
And you know, that is how we get the Book of Mormon. That's how we get South Park. That's how we get the Civil Rights Movement. These acts of moving against, you know, the status quo and what people have come to expect, that, you know, takes an enormous amount of force and energy to push through. And it's only on the other side that we really come to accept it as creative and we apply that label to it. Early on, it might seem subversive. Early on, it might seem dangerous. Early on, it might seem actually crazy.
You, at some point, you say the two people in a pair leave behind the rest of the world. And there's this great quote from C.S. Lewis that you put in the book, "Every real friendship is a sort of secession, even
yes.
rebellion." So you, and I guess it's that leap of faith, right? You're saying, all right, I'm going to leave this broader context and I'm going to trust you and we're going to go on this journey together.
That's right. And there is a progression that you can see that's helpful because we, you know, can, in the end, it's this act of faith and this feeling of joining with another person and this feeling of complete surrender. But that does take a great deal of time. And it begins with something called confidence, which is just, well, it really begins with that feeling of chemistry or electricity that we've gone over. But then once you know that someone can arouse you and excite you, you need to see that they're going to show up. And that's where confidence comes in, that they're going to be there on time. And when you turn to them repeatedly, you can count on them being there. And from confidence emerges this quality of trust. And trust is a feeling that you can really give yourself over. You can throw yourself across the room and be caught. And eventually trust dissolves into something much more encompassing and harder to name, which is faith. And part of a faith experience, coming to faith in something is directing one's attention to it and away from other things. And that's the root of, you know, these words like holy and sanctified is something that is set apart. And these relationships do become set apart in the minds and the lives of the pairs who are involved. And it can be really stunning to behold. And it can even be a little alienating for people around them because they have a sense that there's something happening in that nucleus that they can't be a part of it. And it can be really bedeviling for historians and journalists who are trying to study them because it's so... you know, very often what makes a pair is that they choose not to disclose things that pass between them to others.
Right.
And so we may not know, just like we don't know so much of what happened between Lennon and McCartney. Georges Braque and Pablo Picasso created Cubism together. And one of the very few statements that Braque ever made about those 6 years was that what passed between us, no one will ever know. So it's really his only statement about it was a kind of a statement of non-disclosure. And they, at that time, they would sign the canvases on the back
right.
in order to hide from the public who had done what. And of course, now we can trace it, but it was a deliberate intention to efface the individual into this collective.
When you're talking about Picasso, he's also the other part of another great partnership, one that expresses another element of all of this, and that is competition or coopetition, as you put it in the book. And we'll talk about that when we get back from a break. We have with us Joshua Wolf-Schenck. We're talking about his book, Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. And We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio, back now with the writer Joshua Wolf Shank. We're talking about his new book, Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. In many of these great pairs you write about, there's this paradox built into the relationship. There's, on one hand, you've got this yearning to work together with this person, and you have so much in common, and you've come to trust them. But that plays against this other yearning, this desire to win and to be the leader and to be the best. And I guess that tension, that competition, is a crucial way of how this really works, these creative partnerships.
Yeah, both things are in play, and we tend sometimes to think of them as opposites, that cooperation and competition are two totally different things. But in fact, very often the people who bring out the best in us are also rousing us to an ability to perform. One extreme example is outright competitors.
Right.
And
Bird and Johnson.
Bird and Johnson are a great example, that they wanted to beat each other. They actually took pleasure not just in the win, but in the other guy's suffering. And that, you know, kind of fierce competitive desire over time made each one better, and they came to see that they needed the other guy. They needed the other guy in the game. And after 12 seasons in the NBA, when Magic retired, Bird retired at the end of the same season. And you see the same dynamic between Pablo Picasso and Henri Matisse, that they wanted to top the other, and it was vexing and frustrating what the other guy was doing. And yet they knew that it brought out the best in them. And by the end of their careers, they both thought that really in the whole field of art, you know, Matisse thought that Picasso was really the only one who mattered, and Picasso thought the same about Matisse.
Picasso was pushing Matisse in a direction. Matisse was pushing Picasso in a direction. And you say that it wasn't really the story of enemies being turned into friends. It was enmity and comedy intertwined in a double helix, you say, which is really interesting.
So many of these themes really are that, you know, solitude becomes entwined with connection, and difference and dissimilarity and tension becomes entwined with alignment and rapport. And yes, here again, competition and a kind of opposition, a pushing up against someone, becomes aligned with a cooperation.
I want to ask about this. I'm not sure if it's the ugly part of these creative partnerships, but it does give a little bit more nuance to the story. This is what you describe in the book as the Hitchcock paradox. This is where you have one partner who tries to dominate the relationship, and it can, at least it seems, it can be at times kind of brutal or petty or ruthless anyway. I mean, Alfred
Yes.
Hitchcock is one, and Anna Wintour is one. And, I mean, you have a number of examples of that. This is under a section you called Alphas and Betas. This is the Alphas part. You want to explain that?
Yeah, you know, Steve Jobs is another example that comes readily to mind. A tyrannical man, an abusive man. His wife said of his relationship with Jonathan Ive, who was his design guru and his last great stage at Apple, that Steve really cared for Johnny. He never went out of his way to deliberately humiliate him. That is a sign of, that's Steve Jobs being respectful. And yet, very often, these tyrannical, difficult figures who seem profoundly asocial are actually interacting with others in a way that rouses them and brings out their best. And Steve Jobs is a great example of this enigmatic but recurring pattern, that he was simultaneously beastly to other people, but he had an eye for talent, he had an eye for the people that he could connect with. And it began with Steve Wozniak, with whom he created Apple Computer to begin with, and flash forward to the iPhone and the iPad that he created with Johnny Ive, and so much of Apple was collaborative, and it was about Jobs interacting with these other people that he often spotted from across a room, and he drew towards him to create together.
So you've got the Alphas, the Jobs, and you've got the Betas, the Wozniaks, and frankly, McCartney is a beta. I mean, John Lennon clearly was an alpha in that relationship. Were they, you know, these are partners who managed to be deferential, but they also managed to push back. And I wanted you to spend a little bit more time talking about the alpha beta relationship between Lennon and McCartney, because this is a story I was fascinated by, this moment that illustrates the kind of the depth and the character of the relationship between Lennon and McCartney. John, you describe as the dreamy king. Paul is the fervent deputy. And they have this, there's the story you tell about during the Sgt. Pepper sessions. Sgt. Pepper, of course, that brilliant album. And they were working on It's Getting Better, a terrific song. And basically they have this joint acid trip. And I wanted you to tell that story because it seems to reveal something about their relationship.
Mm, yeah. Paul was not generally interested in psychedelics and actually was, did a lot less tripping on all kinds of substances than John did. And in the mid-60s, this was a huge part of Lennon's life. He said that he must have taken acid 1,000 times, and Paul did it very reluctantly, only a handful of times. But this night, they were in the studio, and John looked in his pill box and was thumbing around, and he took something that he probably thought was an upper. It turned out to be a pretty significant dose of acid, and he began to hallucinate in the studio, and they clearly needed to wrap up, and Paul decided that he would join him on the trip, and he took him home around the corner to Paul's house, and they, spent the night on this trip, and Paul had this vision of John as he said, the emperor of all eternity. John was just sitting there, not saying or doing much. But I think that Lennon did represent to Paul, a kind of supreme power. And Paul McCartney is a puzzling character because he's an extremely aggressive guy, mm-hmm. and loves to dominate his situation, loves to be in control, actually seems to have a very hard time not being in control. And yet in John Lennon, he met someone to whom he would defer. And John Lennon is someone who loved power, but actually needed other people to enact his vision. And so he saw in Paul McCartney someone who he could be the kind of king of their empire together, but he could invest in Paul a kind of, as a king would in a prime minister or in a conciliary, operational power. And so you have a kind of dance between them where Paul actually was the operational leader in the studio. On stage, he would be the one making announcements and cracking jokes, and John would be sort of hanging back watching him, and then periodically would inject himself, in a very aggressive way to make sure everyone remembered that he was in fact the king. And so you have this dance of power between them that has a kind of stability, but also these moments of shock. Early on, as boys, they decided they would co-credit everything they did. And when they began to publish, Paul had the lead position, probably because he was the more advanced songwriter. So these songs were McCartney, Lennon. And then all of a sudden, John decided they were going to reverse it.
Right.
And Paul was thunderstruck, but he then deferred, which was his way. And when you look at what happened in the great shock of the late 60s, when the tension began to boil up and they eventually ceased to work together, it was a similar thing. After many years of deferring to Paul, John decided he needed to get back in the mix, and he did some things that had lasting repercussions, because it wasn't simple as it was in the early days. He was clubbing Paul over the head, but it was a blow that really lasted, because what he did was he brought in a new manager summarily without consulting Paul. And it was a guy Paul couldn't work with, and a really problematic guy named Alan Klein. And that was a big part of what led to the stoppage and their magnificent work.
Well, stoppage, but let's point out, you don't use the word breakup, and you do that consciously. I mean, because this is one of the elements of this story. You do say, of course, that partnerships do break down like a human body. You know, a system failure can take it down. But it seems like partnerships like Lennon and McCartney, they have these really long arcs. John, of course, was killed in the 1980s. I can't remember, 82, I think it might have been. But there's a reason to believe, you say, that their partnership may have had a stoppage, as you put it, but it wasn't over.
Yeah. Yeah, these partnerships do go on beyond the end of the discrete work, because so much of the connection is a psychological connection. And you may not be in the same room with that person or even speak to that person, and yet you are bound up with them, and your identity is bound up in the work that you've done together. And very often, alongside whatever frustration or difficulty people encounter that leads them, you know, to a place of not being able to work, there is the ongoing desire and yearning, and the sense that something greater is possible with that other person than alone. Mm. And Lennon and McCartney did carry on that desire even after what we think of as a breakup. And it's very likely that had John Lennon lived, they would have returned to work together. It was there were a number of moments after the breakup, so-called, when they had the desire and circumstances kept them apart. And John actually wasn't recording music for much of the last half of the 70s, but he returned to the studio to make Double Fantasy with Yoko, and he was talking actively about how he wanted to get together again with Paul.
There's kind of this last image that was really powerful that you write about the story, where they're doing the Abbey Road rooftop concert, that famous concert up there, and they're doing Don't Let Me Down. And there's a moment when John Lennon flubs the lines on that song, and he looks over at Paul, and then they go right onto the next lyric, correct it.
Yes.
And it's like they're back in sync again. And it's such a poignant image, because you know they're not long for this world as a band, at least as that current makeup. But they're still connected in some way. It's such a great scene.
Yeah. Yeah, and the joy and the levity that is possible, with someone that you have so much experience with and aren't so in sync with, it is always possible for us to return to it. And this is the idea of repair.
Yeah.
And if we all will encounter challenges. Challenges are built into these relationships, and yet we can return to the source of joy and the source of possibility. And that's what you see in that moment. It's incredibly moving to me. And if you look at the video and you see the smiles on their faces, and Paul's head is bobbing up and down, and John just is beaming from this little moment of being in total sync with one another, and that is the kind of joy that is available to all of us through these kinds of connections.
I want to end with this. I mean, you resisted the advice of your editor, whom you write about, by the way, in terms of partnerships. We don't have a lot of time to get into that, but your editor, in this sort of give and take of your own partnership, said, you know, you should give a kind of exhortation to readers about embracing the possibility of pairs in their own lives. You pushed back a little bit. In the end, you kind of gave in, and I wanted you to say something about that. What is it that we can learn from these remarkable partnerships, the Currys and Wozniak and Jobs and Magic and Larry? What can we learn from that in terms of our own kinds of relationships? Because it seems like you can make a connection and make this apply to our own relationships, to friendships and marriages and those kinds of things.
Yes, and to creative work too. I mean, if you have the aspiration to make something beautiful in your life, to change the world, or to even change one mind by making something beautiful or meaningful, connection is the path.
Yeah.
And reaching out beyond yourself to other people who can support you, or who you can support, or with whom you can become something together beyond what you can do on your own. That is, if you look at the history of creativity, that is the root unit of things. And there's an enormous amount of fear involved, and there's an enormous amount of uncertainty involved. And so there's a kind of, I think, you know, the book for me is like a kind of a charge of energy, you know, out of myself and out of this lonely, fearful place, you know, to the possibilities that exist all around me. And it may be in a relationship that is ongoing with someone who's already your colleague or with someone who is a domestic partner, but in practice actually is a critical player in your creative life. These relationships can take all forms. It may be that it's someone that you haven't yet met and you need to, you know, tune in to, on a very subtle level, the feeling of connection with other people and who kind of sends your needle all the way to the right. And that feeling of electricity and excitement and possibility and humor. And this is where I am in my life day to day. I mean, I'm trying to pay attention to the relationships that are ongoing and cultivate them and have patience with them and appreciate all their good qualities and tolerate all their difficult qualities. And I'm also constantly noticing, you know, who speaks to my best self.
Yeah.
And how do I then return with the stuff of myself that will feed that sense of interaction?
The last thing you do is to finish, you say, or at least surrender. Give over the thing that you've created and then start over again. But do it, you know, take the first step and give in, I guess.
Yeah, and there's a way in which we are making children with this work. And it is, it, you know, we the pair is primary in terms of the process, but the product is a gift to the world. And there's a kind of, just as you have to surrender as you come into a pair, the pair also has to surrender the work to the response of, you know, whoever its audience is. And that then comes back in return and actually makes the pair, how people regard that work and whether they appreciate it or don't.
Joshua Wolfshank. His book is called Powers of Two, Finding the Essence of Innovation in Creative Pairs. Joshua, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you for your just a lovely and deep reading of the work and for a marvelous conversation.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Mike Anderson. Our theme music is composed by The Moth and the Flame. Michael Shea is our intern, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.